From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We have come a long way since the first doses of vaccine were administered in our state on December 15th, and since vaccine supplies really began to ramp up at the beginning of February. Deliveries continue to rise and are expected to increase by millions more this spring. With the increased supply, Illinois is now averaging 100,000 vaccinations a day. That's about 1% of all adults in Illinois getting a shot each day, and I expect that number to continue to grow in the weeks ahead. That's why I'm pleased to announce that I'm directing every jurisdiction that receives allotments of vaccine through the state of Illinois to expand eligibility to all residents 16 and older on Monday, April 12th. By mid-April, we will be at a point where dividing up the population into phases won't make sense with the ever-increasing supplies that we expect to see.
Governor J.B. Pritzker, this week he made some changes, or at least announced those, that are coming to the state's COVID vaccine program, along with the roadmap for reopening Illinois. We'll discuss that, and it's also feeling a bit more like a regular legislative session. Bills are moving. We'll discuss it all. Welcome to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler, Emeritus Professor and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie is also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Also with us, we have Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois State House Editor, and joining us today, Sarah Manser, a reporter for Capital News Illinois. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And so, Hannah, let me go to you first. The governor made a big move this week, not completely unexpected. Those outside Chicago, 16 and older, can start getting the vaccine April 12th. And this should allow the vaccine rates in the state of Illinois to really bump up pretty quickly, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that seem to be the case?
That's right. And we're already moving at a pretty good clip, when you compare it to last month. So the governor has announced this new, quote-unquote, bridge phase. Based on pretty good vaccination rates. And yes, on April 12th, that's when the, eligibility will expand to everyone 16 and older. And, if you'll recall last week, President Joe Biden in his primetime speech, he had made this call to states, to saying by May 1st, we would like to direct all states to open up eligibility to, everyone who 16 and over. And so this is, it's also kind of a symbolic move too, because this is the 1 year anniversary this week of the first COVID death, in Illinois. And now we've had over 21,000 Illinoisans die from COVID over the last year. But, of course that is, it's really sad, hard anniversary to mark, but it's also marked with some hope.
Yeah, Charlie, this move here, I know there are still some elderly people who have not received the vaccine, probably some with underlying health conditions still waiting on that as well. But is the time right to open it up like this, to just go ahead and say, okay, enough time has passed and the vaccine supply seems good enough and that it's going to actually increase, that we should start getting this in more arms?
Well, I think we've been at this for a year now, and the numbers are starting to look good. And the concern is reaching people in, what would you say, medically underserved neighborhoods, who tend to be people who are Black or people who are Latino. And there's been an effort made, particularly in the city of Chicago, to try and target those areas for the vaccines. In terms of I think it's been more than a week now, the city of Chicago has said people in certain zip codes can get the vaccine. And that was an effort to reach out to those communities on the south side and on the west side that were being underserved. But as we move forward, and as the percentage of people vaccinated continues to move up, yeah, I think it makes sense to try and lay out here are the metrics we're going to follow so we can finally move back to some semblance of normalcy. And I know that it's all contingent upon the numbers continuing to move in the right direction. Now, the number of people vaccinated obviously will continue to go up. It's not going to go down. And the thing that'll be watched is how many new infections are there? What's the impact on the hospitals? What's the mortality rate? Those kinds of things. And if those numbers continue to stay where we hope they'll be or go down, we could be looking at being fully reopened probably within a couple of months.
Yeah, Sarah, the governor seemed to be, again, trying to walk this line, I think, you know, that all leaders during this pandemic have done, which is you want to tell people still take precautions, still wear masks, you know, try to social distance when possible. Don't put yourself in any type of risky position there. But at the same time, he's also trying to show optimism that things are getting better. Politically, he's, again, having to straddle that line, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think that was part of his message today when he spoke and made a comment that, you know, the pandemic isn't over. So while he's trying to make it clear that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, that we're very close to, or we're closer than we've ever been, he, I think, is also conscious of what you mentioned, that people may decide, you know, masks are not necessary anymore, or, you know, gathering limits aren't going to be abided by. So I think that's something that he has to balance very carefully, and he's very aware of.
I want to go back to this bridge phase idea, because I think it might be hard for some people that really haven't paid a lot of attention or don't know all of the different phases of reopening in the state, what it means. Hannah, it's a bridge to get us to the point, I guess, we all want to be at, but it, like Charlie had mentioned a moment ago, there's a lot of metrics that have to be met for this to work.
That's right. So, you know, if you remember, early last May, the governor released his so-called Restore Illinois five-phase plan that's supposed to get us back to, you know, kind of operating as normal. But so many things have, you know, in retrospect, the, you know, bridge for going from phase four, which is where we've been at since July, despite those steps backward that we took during the fall, you know, second wave of COVID and the mitigations that were baked into the phase four. You know, we've come a long way, but no one really knew, could visualize what would be happening this spring or like how we would truly get to phase five. And so it's become very clear that we needed some sort of bridge. And so here, I will read you some of the metrics on how we get there. So phase four, which is where we are now, in order to get to this so-called bridge, we'll have to have 70% of residents 65 and older having received their first dose of a COVID vaccine. Right now, that metric is getting there, but we're not quite there. Once we are there, however, we will be monitoring in a 28-day period, but it could last longer. And once we reach 50% of residents 16 and older having gotten their first dose of the vaccine, then we can move into phase five. However, the governor says that even in phase five, the state mask mandate will still be in place. And he is punting to the CDC to make the decision on when it's safe to go maskless in public again. And, you know, some of the increased capacity limits in this so-called bridge phase might not be super noticeable. For example, in retail stores currently allowed to have 50% capacity, it's only moving to 60% capacity in the so-called bridge phase. However, you know, if you were to have a wedding or another large quote unquote social event, the current cap is 50% or 50 people or 50% of a room's max capacity in normal times. That number is moving way up to 250 people. And if you can prove that you're fully vaccinated, that person will not count against capacity limits. So that's a pretty big increase. So it's not even all over, but also, you know, like I said, we could be in this bridge phase for as little as 28 days, possibly longer. So, you know, it seems like before we know it, we might be back to kind of normal operations, which is just wild after a whole year of, you know, living in this mentality where we should stay home as much as possible.
Yeah, Charlie, I don't think the governor's decision this week has anything to do with politics, but at the same time, shutting down the economy, some of the other changes that have had to be made in the past year, they don't necessarily make you extremely popular. So from a political standpoint, is this also a move that could help Pritzker, it seems, going forward, because everybody wants to see things reopen and get back to, like Hannah said, at least some level of normalcy.
Yeah, and my take on all of it is that the governor has not been motivated by politics at all, because the most politically advantageous thing to have done would have been to say, well, we can keep business going. We don't really, you know, this won't be any worse than the flu. It'll just kind of go away, as the former president said. But Pritzker came down hard. He shut things down to try and stop the spread. And we'll never be able to tell how many people's lives were saved by that. But I think it stands to reason that there are some people alive today that, had the state not taken such drastic measures, would not be with us now. And this strikes me as a very measured response. As we were discussing earlier, there are certain metrics that have to be met. And if the numbers start going the wrong way, if suddenly the infections raise dramatically, or if suddenly we have more fatalities, those kinds of numbers, those metrics, then we'll be right back where we are today in terms of a lot more restrictions. So I think the governor described it not as an on-off switch, but kind of as a dialing, where you slowly adjust it. It's sort of like with your faucet. When you turn on a faucet, you don't turn it on full blast. You kind of turn it on a little bit, and the water starts to come out, and then more comes out. I don't know if that's a good, analogy or not, but it's gradually moving back to where we all want to be and always following the metrics. And now he's been criticized on it. I think, wasn't it Senator Bailey, who's a avowed candidate for governor, Republican candidate for governor, who said, well, there's a bridge, and then we have a ferry, and who knows what. And he's been somebody who's been arguing that the state should be open from day one, kind of personal responsibility. And if you want to go out in a bar and take a chance of catching COVID, that's your right.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Sarah Manser of Capital News, Illinois. Sarah, we remember the election wasn't that long ago, and some changes had to be made due to the pandemic to make it easier for people to vote and to also try to avoid spreading COVID-19. That was, you know, vote by mail, curbside voting. And now apparently there's an effort to make this the norm. I guess that's not surprising, but what's going on with this legislation?
Yeah, this legislation essentially does make a lot of those changes that were adopted for the 2020 election permanent moving forward. And so this bill, it's House Bill 1871, passed the House yesterday. And so it still needs to pass the Senate, but it would essentially allow election authorities across the state to use drop boxes if they so choose, and to allow for curbside voting. Both were adopted during the 2020 election. And also, it would require election authorities to accept postage-free ballots. So it would require election officials to have postage-free collection sites where, election authorities would have to accept ballots that did not have the required amount of postage. And this measure was opposed by a lot of Republicans in the House who thought that it didn't go far enough in securing these collection sites. They argued that there need to be more required security measures in the bill, and also there need to be more regulations surrounding where these collection sites can be placed, so that election authorities cannot use the placement of these sites to sway the outcome of the election. However, the things that the Republicans wanted to have in the bill were not taken up.
Do county clerks, are they for the most part on board with this, or are they sort of waiting to see what happens with it?
I think these types of measures are supported by most county clerks in the state. I think it gives them the ability to expand access if people are unable to vote in person on election day. People can easily access these drop boxes or curbside voting. So I do think it is supported by a lot of clerks, and also the bill itself doesn't require a lot of this, so it does give some discretion to county clerks. So if they don't want to take up these expanded voting provisions, they aren't necessarily required to.
Let me move on to some other legislation, because, again, as I mentioned at the start of the show, it's seeming a little more like we're getting somewhat back to normal with legislation being called, bills moving through the process. Hannah, one of those that did not move through the process back in January when the lame duck session was there, the Black Legislative Caucus had pushed a whole pillar or a lot of legislation. One pillar of that involved health legislation that did not get through. Now they're trying again. What would this do?
That's right. The healthcare pillar of the Legislative Black Caucus's four-pillar agenda, which for listeners, remind their criminal justice, education, and access to economic opportunity. And so this health pillar, it just ran out of time at the end. There was so much going on. This bill would do things like have a hospital closure moratorium. You know, there's been a lot of cases in the last several years, and of course it's intensified by the pandemic. You know, in a lot of places in the state, especially in the city of Chicago's south and west sides, but this is also an issue in rural communities, hospitals are closing because they just can't make ends meet. And so this would address that in certain ways. A lot of things that had been in the bill in January were taken out because they just were too unrealistic, but there was a lot still left in. So it would create an anti-racism commission that would identify, you know, policies to eliminate systemic racism in medicine, because there's a lot of evidence that, you know, if I am a Black woman and I go into my doctor, on the whole, doctors will take white patients' pain more seriously and actually try to investigate and identify. And this leaves a lot of Black patients kind of just floating out there with no solution. It also requires implicit bias training, which also goes along with that, creates this new kind of certification for this thing called community health workers, which the bill sponsors, they say that they want a kind of wraparound service. Is not just you going to the doctor. Healthcare is, you know, getting all the other things that you need to live a healthy life, and, you know, having access to, you know, other services, mental health, all these other things. It's kind of the same principle as what a Medicaid managed care organization, you know, that's the goal of that. But ironically, the Black Caucus was so upset in their original legislation with how the managed care organization rollout has gone in Illinois that they sought to eliminate it and cancel all the contracts. That stuff's out of bill. But the Republicans did not, you know, vote for this bill because their projections for the total cost of this bill is anywhere from $5 billion to $12, $15 billion a year, which is astronomical. And the bill sponsor was like, well, you know, the stuff in the bill is subject to appropriations, and to which the Republicans shot back. So, you know, it's an unfunded mandate, and it's also, you know, ripe for broken promises. And that isn't that kind of the story of Illinois, where, you know, legislation promises all this stuff, but we don't actually have the revenue streams to address it and actually fully fund these things.
Well, also on the House floor this week, and this actually refers back to something that took place in January of this year. Sarah, there was a state House member, the focus of a resolution that did pass. It condemned him for attending the Trump rally in Capitol Hill the day of the insurrection in January. This is Chris Miller. He is married to a congresswoman, Mary Miller, who's also gotten quite a bit of attention in a very short period of time being in Congress. So what was this resolution all about?
So Chris Miller, he was at the Save America rally on January 6th in Washington, D.C. That took place right before the riot at the Capitol, where Trump supporters violently stormed the Capitol, and there were deaths that resulted. Chris Miller, he said on the House floor yesterday when this resolution was up for a vote to be adopted, that he did not take part in that riot and that he was in lockdown with his wife in their office in the Capitol and had no part. But the resolution was introduced by Representative Bob Morgan from Lake County, and it condemns Representative Miller for attending that rally and for having a decal on his car that is an insignia of a group known as the Three Percenters, which has been identified as a paramilitary group, an anti-government militia group. The resolution passed on the floor yesterday. It was quite a contentious vote. On the Democrat side, they maintained that this was not about Chris Miller's free speech, but the substance of his speech, and that he should have known that participating in that rally, that rally would have led to violence. However, this his attendance at this rally is the subject of a complaint with the legislative inspector general. That complaint is ongoing and in the process, and that was raised by members of the House Republicans, who said that this resolution is premature, that the Democrats need to wait until the legislative inspector general, you know, comes to a decision or releases findings on this complaint. So that resolution has been adopted and in the record, and we'll have to wait and see what comes of the legislative inspector general complaint.
Charlie, just a few seconds left here, but real quick, I mean, it doesn't sound, at least at this point, like there's anything illegal that he has done that we're aware of. And like Sarah said, there's this investigation that's going on by the inspector general. Does this jump the gun a little bit?
Well, the resolution basically says that Chris Miller has violated his oath. And interestingly enough, resolutions begin with a whole bunch of whereases. Where is this? Where is that? Where is the other thing? Therefore, and this resolution, the last whereas, says, whereas a formal complaint was filed by members of the General Assembly referring this matter for investigation to the Illinois Legislative Inspector General. So in a way, yeah, it kind of is jumping the gun, and the resolution itself recognizes that because it says we've already referred this matter to the Inspector General. And the roll call, there were 57 representatives voted yes, 36 voted no, 5 voted present, but quite a few people didn't bother to vote at all. And as a matter of fact, there was only one person who crossed sides. The Republicans, 35 of them voted no, 3 voted present, a couple didn't vote, some were excused. Only one Democrat voted against it, and that is a representative named Mark Walker, who's from the Northwest suburbs. I don't know if he explained why he voted no, but other than that, it was a very partisan roll call.
All right, time now for our notes from the field. Hannah, let's go to you first.
So representing yet another step away from longtime House Speaker Mike Madigan, new Speaker Chris Welch this week announced the formation of a different PAC, political action committee, I should say, to elect House Democrats. And he closed out the Democratic Majority PAC, which had been Madigan's longtime fund to elect House Democrats. But, you know, of course, the money had to go somewhere. So Welch's new committee inherited that nearly $900,000.
Sarah?
On the House floor, on Thursday, when the House came back into session, it appeared that the new House Speaker, Chris Welch, gave his members some gifts, and it appeared that they were a sash that said Black History Made, first Black House Speaker, something like that, and then a paperweight in the shade of Illinois, the colors green, yellow, and red. It reminded me of when former House Speaker Michael Madigan gave his members a present in the form of a desk clock. He did not give this present to one member who's no longer in the General Assembly, former Representative Scott Drury, because that representative did not vote for him when he was elected, I believe in 2017. So I think this time around, everyone got a present.
And Charlie?
In the debate in Congress before this last huge relief package was approved, there was a lot of talk about coming from Republicans, particularly in the Senate, that we shouldn't have to bail out all these blue states, these poorly managed Democratic-controlled states. And interestingly enough, WalletHub, which is a financial analytical firm website, had a report that came out talking about the most and least federally dependent states. And guess what? The blue state of Illinois ranks 48th in terms of its return on taxes paid to the federal government and its share of federal funds. Only New Jersey and Delaware get less back, but Kentucky, who, if I'm not mistaken, has a member of Congress who is very outspoken about how bad it was to have to bail out the blue states, they came in 5th. South Carolina, it also has a very outspoken senator, came in 6th.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Sarah Manser of Capital News Illinois. Get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org, or you can go through the NPR One app and join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.